You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. When I read Alan Alda's new book, I hear his voice in my head. Do you? It could be probably because we all heard him as Hawkeye Pierce on our TVs for so many years, and for me, watching MASH reruns with my father, a World War II vet, was one of our true bonding experiences. I really wish my father could be here to hear Alan Alda tonight. I know it's going to be such a treat. Alan Alda speaks so eloquently in his new book about the need for empathy in our daily lives, in our workplaces, and on the world stage. Not being able to communicate, he writes, is the Siberia of everyday life. Empathy, he points out, is the bedrock of communication. And he mentions in the book his conversation with his friend, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who observes how empathy enhances the law and moves it closer to the greater good, which reminded me of how fortunate we were to present Justice Breyer in this very same space on the same stage a few years ago. Alan Alda has won 7 Emmy Awards, among many other honors and international recognition. And of course, you know him not just from the TV, West Wing, and the classic series MASH, but from films like Crimes and Misdemeanors, Bridge of Spies, and many more. He's a very active member of the scientific community, which he's managed to join without being a scientist. No easy feat. He hosted the award-winning series Scientific American Frontiers for 11 years and founded the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook. He cares about how science is communicated. And as a program curator, I too look for those scientists who can tell a story and connect with a non-science audience. Mr. Alda has used techniques of improvisational theater to help scientists connect with their peers and their audiences. Teaching improvisation to engineers, that's a really crazy idea, except it turned out to not be so crazy. Improvisation doesn't allow for pretend communication, improviso from the Latin, to not see before. In one exercise, he asked engineers to collaboratively build sculptures of pure air to help them, he says, quote, see things that weren't there before, things that exist only by common agreement. Then he notes, it's sort of like what democracy could be if we actually paid attention to one another, which is something really worth contemplating, as is so much else in this valuable new book, If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face? My Adventures in the Art and Science of Relating and Communicating. Alan will discuss his new book and other things unforeseen and unplanned tonight, I'm sure, with Lisa Wolpe, an actress, director, teacher, and playwright who is the artistic director of the Los Angeles Women's Shakespeare Company, which she founded in 1993. Her acting credits and honors are many, including the Jacob Bernowski Award for Theater Excellence and awards from the LA Drama Critics and Playwrights Arena, and she's directed Shakespeare all around the world. We'll be taking your questions after the conversation, and we will circulate a microphone. So please wait until the microphone comes to you. We'll try to get to as many as we can. Please make your question a question. Always appreciated. And now please join me in welcoming two great actors and thinkers, Alan Alda and Lisa Wolpe. Thank you.
Thank you.
What a tremendous bath of love is heading towards you.
I love you too. Well, some of you anyway. My daughter is here tonight and two of my grandsons.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Alan was just saying in the wings how many young women sat with their fathers and watched MASH and created a personal communication within themselves and were able to unpack stories about the war because of your humanity, because of the reality of the stories, because of the expertise. You know, you were rocking that handsome look with your dog tags and your martini glass. Hot Lips Houlihan was making the air jiggle.
That must have been what brought the children and their fathers together.
Yes, I think so.
But it was true that it sounded to me, when I've heard this story many times, and it sounded to me as though the fathers couldn't talk about the war with their daughters and didn't bond with them in other ways. But by watching the show, they would open up to them. And sometimes I've heard that these women's fathers, for the first time, would cry and tell them stories about things that they had never told the family before that. That I think that may be because it wasn't just a made-up story. We based the stories on people who had really lived through a horrific experience. And the awareness that it was about real people, I think, was underneath everything, and I think that helped. It helped people to relate to it.
And now we're sort of overwhelmed with bad news quite a lot, and we see something like young Aylin, the 3-year-old refugee from Turkey, who we saw face down in the sand in Greece, and that how do we keep the humans in our lives real and relatable instead of that disengaged mist of the 65 million refugees that we can't care about? Yeah. And the Pope invoked our need to really tell stories about individual people so that we can stay alive to empathy.
Yeah, because we don't relate to millions of people. We don't relate to statistics. We relate to personal stories. That's why the picture of that boy changed the behavior of nations, or at least it changed their promise to behave differently. And they were going to take in a lot of refugees, because that kid, as you may remember, a year or two ago, he and his family were trying to escape from Syria, and somebody had sold them a raft that didn't work, and everybody drowned, and the father was trying desperately to keep them afloat. And I think the father was the only one who survived, and the little boy, was photographed face down at the edge of the water. And that picture rocketed around the world and became a rallying point for people to suddenly realize that the Syrian refugees were people like them. And that's so interesting, because that's an image of what we try to train scientists to do. The scientists work in detail, and when they talk about their work, they tend to talk about the detail and talk about it first and usually all the way through, whereas we want to hear why we care about it, because we're not trained in the same way that the scientists are, so we want to hear things that are human and captivating to us. So that's why we teach them to tell stories, and we start by teaching them improvisation so they get used to contact and they like the contact. Then they can turn to an audience and make that same contact.
You said that women have a greater role in, as physicians, they spend 10% more time with their patients, and the patients then divulge more medical facts about their background, right, that they co-create the healing in a more efficient way. And you said that women in business make the business more successful because they bring a kind of openness to discourse, and that the top 1,500 companies that have more women in managerial positions actually do better financially?
Right, and that's not my opinion. This is derived from studies on the subject. So isn't it interesting, isn't it funny, that it's been shown that the more women rise in a corporation, the better the corporation does in its bottom line? So wouldn't that be sort of self-reaffirming? Wouldn't you think that people would latch on to that and say, well, we got to get more women, we got to get them in more decision-making positions because we'll make more money? But they don't. There's something weird going on.
Yeah, I just came from the Theater Communications Conference in Portland, where the rooms having to do with female leadership were overfilled because there are no people of color or women leading our artistic organizations, and yet 70% of the ticket buyers are female, and 70% of the students in the acting classes are female. Mm. So financially, the people investing in heart-centered stories are women, but the men are deciding the content. And we haven't been able to change those numbers in 25 years of trying.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's. I think it's an awful lot harder than we thought 30, 40 years ago in that particular wave of feminism, where it was thought that it would help a lot if you change the language. You know, it helps a little if you change the language, and I've been part of those efforts sometimes. But I think it goes deeper than that. I think you really it's there's something inherent in the way we're built that has to be negotiated around, has to be navigated around. I just suspect that it's a rich, deep problem, and education helps, but if you get unless you put pressure on it and apply a lot of effort to it, it's not going to change easily.
Because when, you know, actually the boards are the ones that choose artistic directors, and they're mostly white women drawn from the corporate field. But when they close their eyes, when they see a leader, it's a white man, because that's what they've always seen.
Yeah.
And it's
hard
for them to trust outside of what they know can be successful.
We, in order to help raise money for the Center for Communicating Science that I helped start at Stony Brook University, I started a company called All the Training. I can't get it right. It has an easy acronym, ACT. ACT.
Yeah.
All the Communication Training.
That's it.
That's it. Thank you very much. So, our first, we use the training. We take the training that we have developed over the last 8 years, where we've trained 8,000 doctors and scientists in better communication, and we adapted a little bit and offer that training in communication to corporations, leadership, teamwork, you know, media training. But our first program is Women in Business, and it's really exciting to see how this works. And what we're dealing with is the stuff that should have ended decades ago. You know, when we worked so hard to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, there was the Equal Rights Amendment did not get ratified. But the culture changed a lot. Things that were not thought as permissible before that became permissible. However, there are still obstacles to women in business that are just taken for granted. Harassment, for one thing. And I hear from women that they have to like just brush it aside as though it's just part of the terrain. But ordinary things like being interrupted at the conference table, having your idea appropriated by someone else who then gets credit for it when 2 minutes earlier you said it.
Yeah. And that's happening even in the Supreme Court. I looked at the numbers.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. The women in the Supreme Court are interrupted, you know, 300% more than they would
Yeah, and this is supposed to be the highest level of discourse in the country. You know, these very bright, well-educated, fair-minded people who are deciding what's fair for the whole country, and yet they interrupt the women. So we do, we teach improv exercises to make, which is, the best basis for communication. And then we role play, because now they're opened up and able to role play. So sometimes in the workshops, I play the boss, and a woman is playing the part of sort of herself, but she's coming into the boss with something that she needs from the boss. You want to be, well, just do it. You want to be it? You want to do a little thing?
Yes. So let's use mansplaining and interrupting. Do you know what mansplaining is?
Yeah, no.
Well, I know what it is. I do it.
This is a big topic in social media. So if I say, becoming a great Shakespearean actress, requires an understanding of the sympathetic nature of the villain. Alan would then say, yes, I've played Iago, and I'll tell you exactly how to do that. And never ask me that if I've played Iago, which I have, you know. So we have that in common. What's our subject?
Well, you pick it.
Well, let's do, I would like to be the artistic leader of the Alan Alda communication program.
That's great. Well, thanks for coming in.
I'm so grateful to have this opportunity. You know,
oh, the opportunity is all mine. I've heard your, I saw your resume. Really good. You've done some very interesting stuff. Did you do the production in St. Louis? I can't remember.
Well, I've done this work for 40 years, and the most recent one is we had an all-female production in Harlem.
Boy, that must be really tough to do. I mean, the world kind of is, do they dress up as men?
Yes. Actually, I've played more of the male roles than any woman in history, so
I feel kidding.
Like, you know, having stepped into
You know what they used to call that? They used to call that trouser parts. I love that. So you did trouser parts, huh?
Yes, it's a long tradition. Some of the greatest actresses in the world have played...
Yeah, Ellen Terry, I know Ellen Terry did it.
Yes.
Yeah, and Sarah Bernhardt.
Yes, yeah. And Charlotte yeah. Cornwall, and certainly yeah.
You
myself.
You know, she had a wooden leg, did you know that?
She did.
That was an amazing thing. You'd think she'd like limp with it or something, would hold her back.
You know, she was the most famous actress in the world.
Sarah Bernhardt.
No, Charlotte.
Charlotte?
More to the point, Mr. Alda, may I call you Alan?
Sure, why not?
So I've followed your work for decades, and you've taught tens of thousands of scientists now how to communicate. And
yeah,
I'd like
easy,
to be,
I'll tell you, it's not easy, I think.
No. And I'm just wondering, where in the world, since you've taught in many countries, do they have the best empathic response in terms of learning these techniques? And is it, in fact, women who are best at this?
Let me tell you about women.
Alan Alda, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, you know when to call the blackout. That's good.
Well, there's not a better line.
But we used to do
improv
theater in the basement of a hotel in Hyannisport. Somebody in the, you know, we would make up the whole show on the spot. And one of the players would always be off stage with his or her hand on a light switch. And as soon as something funny enough happened, boom, the lights would go out. Because you had to find an ending somehow.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do something just for a moment. You know, the book tells us that not having a leader is almost better. Let's do one big breath together, shall we?
Let's just do
a little bit of breathing.
I haven't breathed in days and days.
Let's do that. So everyone in the room, big breath in. And then just soften your gaze and send your love towards this man. Will you receive all this love for just a moment? I'm going to do an improv with them.
Okay, I'll just wait here.
Thank you. Remember Alan as Hawkeye and just picture him in those dog tags with his grin.
Don't touch that dial.
Bring your mind to your heart. Let your breath come into your heart.
Wait a minute. Have we been holding it all this time?
And now I'd like you to breathe in, if you saw him in your favorite movie, Sweet Liberty, or was it West Wing? And just think of the moment that he really moved himself into the fabric of your soul.
Oh my God.
And now, Alan, if you'd sit down for just a moment, and I'll sit down.
Oh, I fell asleep, wait a minute.
And now just turn to a person next to you in the audience and notice who you're sitting next to. Look at their eyes. Just for a moment, breathing together. See if you can just breathe in and memorize them in the pit of your stomach the moment that you met a friend in the presence of Alan Alda's empathy gift. And now close your eyes. And see if you can paint a portrait of them in your mind's eye. Did you notice the color of their eyes? Can you remember what they were wearing? What was it about them that interested you and that you're curious about? And now just gently open your eyes, and I'm going to ask you to do two things. Say your name to your friend and have them say it back, and then ask each other one question about what made them curious about Alan Alda. Off you go. And rest. Thank you very much for going along on that ride. Thank you. Good job.
This is very interesting. This is very so similar to an experiment I've done with audiences. But now they've turned to the other person you haven't been looking at next to you. Now that person you haven't been talking to, right? Okay, now one of you is person number one, the other is person number two. You decide which is which. Okay? Person number one, you're going to do an improvisation with person number two. Person number one, you're a teenager and you're talking to your parent and you want three times your allowance. You want the allowance to be raised by 300%. The parent, you respond to it. And I'm going to give you 15 or 20 seconds to do that. Go ahead. Go. Okay, good. Good. Thank you. Well, you really want that money, don't you? Hold on. Okay, now, the parents, if you gave in to the teenager, raise your hand.
Tough crowd.
Wait, okay, but it looks like about three people maybe, right? Okay, now, the teenager, close your eyes, look straight ahead. Don't open your eyes now for a second. I want you to try to remember three things about the other person. What color was his or her eyes? Don't say anything yet. The parent, say it out loud now to the parent and let the parent confirm it or deny it. Okay. Teenager, keep your eyes closed. Keep your eyes closed, teenager. Now, what color was the jacket or sweater that the parent was wearing? Keep your eyes closed. Say it to the parent. Okay, let them know if they were right. Okay, now teenager, just what color was the hair of the parent? Okay, now I'm going to ask you how many of these things did you get right? Everybody who got three right, raise your hand. All three.
Three. Five, that's good.
Looks like about 10, 15, huh? How many got two right? How many got one right? Okay, now here's the thing. Now you know how many you got right. Doesn't matter whether you got one or three or none. Turn back to the parent and give you 15, 20 seconds to try again to get. Try now again to get three times your allowance. Go. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Now I want to see, how did the teenagers do? How many people gave in to the teenagers?
A few more.
Well, I would say twice as many. I've only done this three times. The first group gave the teenagers five times as many gave the teenagers. You people are real cheapskates. But the idea is that once you make contact with the other person enough to do what Lisa had you do, to really see them, to be able to see them when you close your eyes, tends to put you in more contact with the other person, and you talk in a more personal way. Something changes in you. And I found this out just working on myself, trying to find, because not everybody can go to an improv class, and improv builds your empathy, and it enables you to get inside the head of the other person, at least in terms of feelings. And I knew that you can lose that if you don't practice it. So I thought, I can't go to an improv class all the time, and people who read the book aren't going to be able to. What if I could figure out an exercise I could do by myself? So I started practicing this, studying people's faces, trying to figure out what their emotions were. And I was telling this to a psychologist, and he said, I'd like to study that. And he did a study, and he found out that not only naming the emotion in your head and figuring it out, but just observing the other person, noticing their hair, for instance. At the end of a week, they did better on an empathy test, a standardized empathy test, than those who didn't do it. So it sounds like, now that's not a true for all time thing, because every study suggests you make more studies. It was a small sample, you know. It's true, but it suggests that it maybe is not a bad idea to try. And when I try it, I get amazing results. Have a seat, I'm getting tired. I did this. When I started to do this, I was experimenting just on myself to see if it worked. So I was at Columbus Circle in New York, and I hailed a taxi. So a cab pulls up, and the guy rolls down the window. He says, where are you going? And I get really furious when a cab driver asks, because it's a law. You got to take them where they want to go. You don't get to ask them where they want to go. I drove a cab in my 20s. I took them wherever they wanted, the Bronx even. I had to dig my car out of the snow at 2 in the morning. But I didn't get upset because I was doing this thing of trying to read the other person. And I thought, it's 4:30 in the afternoon. He probably has to return the car. You know, he's been working all day. He's got to give the car back to somebody else. So I didn't get upset. I said, I told him where I was going. He said, get in. So I got in, gave him the address. He said, what's the cross street? Now I'm getting crazy again. He's the cab driver. He's supposed to know the cross street. Instead of getting mad, I said, I'm looking it up for you on my iPhone. Now we're in an ecstasy of empathy. He says, you know, you're a very nice person. People get in this cab, they don't care about other people. I've had to go to the bathroom for a half an hour. I'm really So I said, so don't drive the whole way there. Drop me off at the corner. I'll walk the rest of the way. He said, no, you're too nice. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take you where you're going. The man is giving up his bladder for me. But the amazing thing was something had changed in me, and then something changed in him. So that when this starts to happen, when we start to make this connection and we're starting to let the other person in, there gets to be a dynamic relationship between us. And the other person lets us in. And all of a sudden, you're having a personal, kind of intimate conversation. And that's when you can have real communication, I think. I think empathy is really important for
you. And Alan has been married for, yeah. I'm just interested that you've been married for 60 years, and it says in the book that people who communicate well have a great deal more sex than people who don't.
Now, that's not just from personal experience. That studies show that. Yes. Of course, my wife says the secret to a long marriage is a short memory, so she's got her own theory about it. But, I think, you know, empathy doesn't necessarily make you a better person or make you easier to live with, because I think empathy is a tool. And if you want to do good, or if you want to make a connection with somebody and have a positive relationship with them, empathy is a really good tool to do it with. But I think there's what I call dark empathy, which is knowing how the other person feels and using it against them. Bullies use it against us.
Clickbait uses it against us.
Yes.
People study all day long how to make us stay on Facebook and pretend that we need to buy the things that we buy. People say they understand us. It might be Hillary Clinton speaking in Arkansas with an Arkansas accent, or Donald Trump having a red baseball cap. They make us feel that we're on the same page,
give us
but
this
are we?
They give us this little shot of dopamine on the apps, on Twitter and Facebook, and we want to come back for more. It's like a slot machine. And you can use empathy, therefore, against other people. Interrogators use it because they know how you feel, and they can make you feel helpless. But if you want to do something positive with the other person, empathy is really helpful. Like, I picture a guy coming home late at night. It's like midnight, and his wife is already asleep. And he passes by the kitchen sink, and he sees this huge pile of dirty dishes in the sink. And he thinks to himself, I guess I ought to do something about that. What are the odds that he does something? On the other hand, if he thinks for a second of what she might feel in the morning if she comes by the sink and sees the dishes and feels that with her, he might be tempted to do the dishes. He might even discover doing the dishes is foreplay.
And that very simple technique, you said, you know, if she comes and says, do you know where the can opener is, instead of just saying, no, I don't, which ends it and isn't helpful, to say, well, it might be in this drawer with the larger spoons.
Yeah.
It feels like you're facilitating a group effort to solve the problem.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I drew that from my own experience because I've done that. And the difference that I notice when I don't say, no, I don't know where it is, the difference between that and saying, maybe it's in that other drawer over there, the difference is sensing what she must feel like when she doesn't know where it is. She's feeling lost and without something. And to just feel that can prompt if you're on the right track and you don't want to disengage from the person, but you really would like to engage with the person, gives you this feeling of cooperating together, just thinking it might be someplace else.
And so much of your work recently, it seems to be about actually noticing the person's face, which doesn't happen digitally. So that when I teach Shakespeare, if I'm asking someone to find an answer to a complex question, to be or not to be, they will literally look down to where the phone would be.
Oh, gee, you know,
this is what happens now. Instead of looking to the eyes and heart to heart,
I know, you know what the trouble is? These are people who haven't discovered Siri yet. Because you don't have to look down at all. You can say, to be or not to be, Siri, what is the answer to that question?
Yes, right? You can.
Yeah. So that's interesting. You're kidding. They really look down at their hand, what to be or not to be?
Yes.
Wow.
They have a sense memory. This is where information comes from. It comes from this gizmo.
To be... That's hilarious. I never...
It would be.
Yeah.
Not if you're directing. About really good acting. So you're not a doctor, but you played one on television. I have to say that my friend Andy became a brilliant pediatrician because he saw you on MASH.
Wow, no kidding. Well, I have actually heard that a few times. Sometimes parents will say to me, my son became a doctor. A couple of times... someone has said, my son became a soldier because he watched you in MASH. And I said, did he watch the whole show?
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, they were the ones getting shot up, but the doctors were just drinking vodka.
Well, not just drinking. You were crossing enemy lines. You were helping the enemy. You were taking small children regardless
of their
skin color.
You're right, I was heroic.
Color.
I know.
Devastatingly so.
But that stuff we were talking about seeing the other face and talking about acting, reminds me that the way I got these ideas, I didn't just come in from left field and think, I know how I can help scientists and everybody else communicate better. I drew on what I had learned as an actor just acting in scenes and also improvising, because I love improvisation. But you know that we were talking before, and we were talking about this. It's so important to me, the difference between saying your line on the stage because it's in the script and it's the next line that comes, and saying your line because the other actor makes you say it, makes you say it a certain way. So that when I was young, that's the way I did it. I figured out a really good performance, not only studying the script, but also during rehearsal, I'd think of how will I do this, it's not how I did the line that mattered, it's how I responded to the other person. That brought life to it. And that, I think, brings life to communication. Where you think where you think about the other person, instead, it's just like not thinking about how to do your line. Communication isn't developing the best message that's a perfect message. It's having as good a message as you can get, but then thinking about who's going to get it. How are you going to communicate? How are you going to relate to that person? Where are they? Where are they in their thinking and in their feeling? And then you have a chance of connecting with them and having the message stick. Otherwise, it's just spraying information at them.
And Mr. Spector, who we met in the lobby, said that he loved your quote, the head bone's connected to the heart bone.
Yeah, that's true. When you get famous, they ask you to talk places where you don't belong. And as soon as MASH hit, I was asked to give the commencement address at the Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons. I'm actually not a doctor, and I said to them when I got out there, I said, maybe the reason they brought me here to talk to you is because they taught you everything they could to make you be a doctor, and now they brought somebody in to show you how to act like one. But what I tried to do is get, it's interesting, I've been training thousands of doctors over the last 8 years, not personally, but with my whole team. And we get them to make personal contact with the patient. And that's what I talked about that day. It was probably in 1973 or something. When was it?
72.
Thank you, Mr. Spector. You were there. You were there that day? Or?
No, I read it.
You read it. Oh, thank you. Well, thank you. So what I talked about that day to those doctors was exactly, I'm making this connection now for the first time. I talked to them about connecting to the patient as a person and not just as a symptom, you know, saying to the nurse, take this to the liver in 312.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.